You know, it's space magic. It's containing the heat. We'll argue about that on a
I
separate
don't, I
episode.
know, no, for sure. I don't like how many things in Star Wars can be just explained away with, it's just the Force. Man.
Harry Potter, yeah, it's magic. I think that's the point.
He writes with monsters. It's philosophy.
Yeah. I think in this case, you have standing.
You're not human. That's hurtful. Are you that guy with the evil powers? I think everyone has dark urges. It's kind of my thing.
Welcome, adventurers, to this episode of the He Who Writes with Monsters podcast. I'm D. Allen.
And I'm Donnie B. How are we doing today?
Doing good. We're trying out a new format today. Figure, you know, this whole thing's new. We're going to try to mix things up, try a different kind of flow. So hopefully this goes well. Tell us what you think.
Absolutely. Well, let's get right into it. Last week, we covered the first stages of this Sanguine horror fight. We started with everybody in the cages, going through finding this ritual tunnel. Jason got out and freed everybody else. We saw the demise of Anissa Vane and Cressida Vane and the Daryl. And now things are starting to heat up, both figuratively and literally.
Yes, they are. And so today we're going to be looking at chapters 12 through 14, and we're going to be covering the Sanguine Horror.
Dun, dun, dun.
Brr, brr, brr. Yeah, dude. Sanguine Horror. So essentially what we're going to cover today is the ritual summoning of the Sanguine Horror. We're going to talk about the battle itself, the monster itself. Basically just go through how it comes about, how they defeat it, and, you know, basically what happens in the aftermath. But there is so much little fun stuff that I want to talk about in this episode. And that's why we want to do something new for this episode, so we can kind of rock and roll with some new fun vibes.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So let's kick this off. Where do we want to start?
All right. So basically, I want to know, are we in the blood cult now?
I don't think we are, but there is definitely some reservations on Gary's side. As we get into it, you know, we see that this ritual is kicking off. And this is one of those cool little things, because as we're going through, you know, the last section that we covered, you know, they're trying to survive. They're getting rid of cultists, getting free and everything. And inadvertently, they are activating this ritual by throwing people into the pit. And
right,
and that's one of those things, like, you're not really thinking about that. You don't know, as a reader, we don't know why they're in the cages, why they're there, how this ritual is supposed to go, and neither do they. And they are trying to stop it, but then inadvertently set it off anyway.
Which to me makes no sense. What? Because all right. Because I don't know, I guess I feel like with magic systems in general, like, someone's got to be casting the spell. So if you've taken out everybody who's casting the spell, how in the hell is the spell continuing to go on? You know what I mean?
Yes and no. So you're thinking about, like, rituals in other magic systems and other fantasy worlds that we've seen where, like, you lay out a diagram and then you cast a spell over it, right?
Right. And that's kind of how I view this magic system, especially when, you know, like, Jason's tracing drops in the rain. Is that this? This is this, right?
That's this, yeah. Not this okay. book, but...
Not this book. Yeah, obviously. Sorry. I thought of, we watch a lot of anime and stuff, so... Or at least I have, and I was like, wait, that could totally just be an anime.
No, I'm sure it happens in animes, too. That's the thing with this magic system in general, though. You have different fields of study, different fields of magic, right? So like spells and abilities and essences, you know, the punition spell that Jason casts is specifically an essence ability. A lot of these verbal spells that they cast come from their essences. And so it's a different kind of school of magic. Rituals in general usually can be performed by anybody. You know, we see Belinda is very, very good at ritual magic and ritual diagrams, and she doesn't get essences, you know, for a while, but mm-hmm. she can do this magic. So it's more of a physical form of magic, right? So this ritual, you know, they set it up, they have the blood pit filled with an alchemical solution. And all they really need is to add the ingredients. It's basically just a big potion pot. There's no spell involved. They're just combining magical ingredients to create a potion. This is basically the alchemy version of it.
Got you. Okay. So, I guess the way I was viewing this then was like we had like a spellcaster over the pit, and what was coming out of the pit was like, you know, the blood or whatnot was specifically like just a product of the spell being cast. Like it was like creating all of that inside the pit.
No, not really. There may have been some magic involved, but in this magic system specifically, spells are inherent to the essences that grant them. They do a specific thing, you know, like there's no, like with Landomir Vane, there's no summon a clockwork core or clockwork.
Spell. So then I guess to clarify, like similar to how Landomir had the ritual circle built into his floor to disguise what he was doing. Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting it's like similar in that way that there's like a physical magical structure in place and all it takes is someone with the right essence ability to continue activating?
No, there's no essence abilities involved at all.
This
is basically the same as like a magic potion, right? If you add the right ingredients to a pot, you're going to get a potion. You don't need an essence ability to create the magic within it. You know,
okay.
There's no create crystal wash spell. It's just an alchemy that anybody can do regardless. Spells aren't generic in this universe. They are very specific. They do very specific things, and they're only granted via specific essence abilities. You know, gotcha. So like Jason can cast Punition because he has the essence ability that gives him that spell Punition. Nobody else can do that without that essence ability.
Okay. I see what you're saying.
Spells are more like attacks, whereas anybody can do ritual magic. Anybody can do alchemy. There are essence abilities that give boons to that. But spells in general don't interact with rituals that way.
Okay. Well, at the very least, that makes a lot of this make more sense to me, because I'm like, how is this ritual even happening if we've just killed everyone who was setting this thing up? Like, but if you're, you know, if all that was left in the recipe was just a couple people, like, I guess it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it comes down to. They're basically just mixing a big potion, and it's going to create a sanguine horror, as we find out. We know all this because of the ritual book that they left. You know, this is the book that Farrah and Jason find, which kind of leads us to this. It's basically just a sanguine horror recipe book, and they're just following the steps within the book to create.
Bro, do you think that like on the page, it's like sanguine horror bisque?
That would be amazing. And be like the blood of 30 virgins. Salt.
Tablespoon of salt.
10 magical plants. A little bit of flour. A big bonfire underneath this pit heating the blood pool.
Got you. Okay. Yeah.
I have a question regarding the book itself.
Okay.
So since we're on that page, as it were, so they find the book. This is how we figure out that they're creating the sanguine horror, basically just alchemy.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a step-by-step guide on what it is and how to make it. We know, we don't know this now, but we know later on with Colin coming around, I feel like this book would be extraordinarily useful for Jason. It's like a guide to your new familiar. So
how does he not get
that book? Like, I understand that Anissa probably confiscated it for her church, but like, you can't just pickpocket that back.
Well, no, hold on though. When would Anissa have even gotten it? Because at this point, she's already gone. She's already left. They have the book in hand at this point. How would Anissa have even gotten the book?
Well, because when they rescue Anissa from the estate, and they clear out all the remaining cultists and they start pillaging, right? There's a whole conversation that we'll get to. With Rufus and Pharaoh wanting to pillage and take the spoils of their victory, right? And Anissa goes through and confiscates literally everything in the building, anything of value, anything in writing or pertaining to the blood cult is taken by Anissa for her church. She claims everything for her church.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I definitely missed that detail.
Yeah, we'll get it. We'll get okay. into it when we get back to the estate here. But
so then okay, I'll give you that. But then yeah, good point. Why doesn't Jason or someone pocket this book?
Right. Like at the very least, I would assume that somebody on this team would think, hey, this is a how-to for apocalypse beasts. Maybe the Adventure Society or the Magic Society should have that. You know, somebody should get that. And then when Colin comes around, they'd be like, hey, I have an idea. Let's read the fucking book.
So there's the error in your thinking. You're thinking of the wrong team members. If Clive was here, absolutely, this book is getting saved. Clive is going to be like, that needs to be kept. I mean, who we have here are literally just the jocks. They don't care that. Well, okay. I guess Farrah cares about books, but.
Right. She's an array specialist, so I would understand her not taking a specific interest in this particular type of magic. But at the very least, you've got Rufus, right? Daddy owns a school.
Right.
He was raised like with that big, big, bad good boy energy, you know? At the very least, he would have been like, hey, anything of value could be used, should be turned into the authorities.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you could just chalk it up to maybe Shirtaloon thought it would just be too easy for the character.
Straight up.
You know, like just like, yeah. I almost feel like he does this a lot where some item or something will come up that would probably make Jason more OP, but he, you know, essentially Shirtaloon decides that Jason doesn't get that because he's going to be OP regardless of that information. So yeah. it could literally be like from the author himself being like, yeah, this could help him. And that actually brings up something that I was thinking about. Is the book more in depth than what Jason develops through learning about the Sanguine Horror through his relationship with Colin?
I feel like yes and no, right? So, you know, as a familiar, he's going to inherently understand a lot more about Colin from like a personal perspective, like what he can do, who he is, how to communicate with him, you know. I feel like the book, with how we see what we see of the book, I feel like it's more of a you want to end the world for dummies type situation. You know, it'll be a lot of the what is a Sanguine Horror, what can it do, you know, how
right to okay it but positively. But that right, but that's the logic that I was getting on, though, is, you know, just through his relationship with Colin, he learns a lot about what Colin can and cannot do, And then, you know, much later, when he gets soulbound and becomes the speaker, what, speaker of the will, voice of the will?
Voice of the will, yeah.
Voice of the will. By that point, I want to say that Jason has a much deeper understanding of the Sanguine Horror. But I think it's a fun thought to think like, all right, like, here you have very studious text-based information that, you know, Jason could have read, may or may not have absorbed, may or may not have helped him in the future. But through his relationship, he gets much deeper knowledge. And I don't know, I feel like that's a big potential element here that Sherloon might be getting at, that, like, you know, relationships and connection is going to be much deeper than just words on a page.
Well, 100%, you know, this would have been just a, you know, like an Iron Rank aid tool. All it would have done is sped up, you know, some of the learning curve.
Sure. So
like, he would have learned a little bit of what he found out a lot faster, but he would never surpass with that book the intimate knowledge that he has, the intimate understanding that he has of Colin, you know, later on down the road. So it would have taken like the first 5% of what he learns and just learns it immediately, like a skill book, you know.
He would have absorbed the
information, but then the practical application would have had to been worked at.
Yeah, 100%. But I think it was an interesting thought I had while I was reading it. Like, I was like, that's kind of, I wonder what would be more in depth, because like, it is a full like textbook ritual book based solely around that creature. Like,
oh yeah. And that I assume that would have been written like as an outside observer type situation. So it's like people who observe the Sanguine Horror or have been given knowledge about it, not somebody who actually had one as a familiar and wrote down everything about it from there.
Right. Is there another character that we know of in past history that had a Sanguine Horror? Do they ever mention a character that had a Sanguine Horror as a familiar?
I feel like
they mention that it's rare, but I don't think they say it's like unheard of necessarily. Yeah. But yeah, it might be unheard of.
They say it's incredibly rare. I think what was specifically stated is, do you have any idea how incredibly difficult it is to get a Sanguine Horror as a familiar?
Right. Yeah.
So I'm sure it's an endless cosmos. It's been around for longer than we can comprehend.
Right.
So I'm assuming it has happened before, probably will happen again, but it's not something that like really is a thing we got to worry about. The most we see is the messenger using a Sanguine Horror on a planet one time, and that being the only thing they couldn't control,
mm-hmm.
you know, getting out of hand like that. So I don't think it's a very common thing to have happen.
Right. And was
it probably has.
And I don't recall, was that messenger, that wasn't a familiar, like that was another summoned Sanguine Horror.
Yeah, that was the same thing that is probably happening here. It's the same thing that they did with the World Taker Worms in book 10, I believe. You know, they just use Apocalypse Beasts to get populations under control, and that was one they just couldn't handle.
Okay, so this actually brings up a thought, though, about the messengers in relation to all of this.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that Landemir was working for the Builder Cult, trying to summon the Builder. And then at the same time, we've got the Blood Cult, unconnected from that, maybe, trying to summon the Sanguine Horror. Well, what if they got the book from the messengers, because the messengers deal with apocalypse beasts? So maybe it's like a messenger how-to book. Like, maybe it was created by messengers, and they, as the Blood Cult, you know, given that they were aristocrats and higher in society, at least to some degree, may have had connections with someone in the messenger sphere and within the builder cultists that might have gotten them that book.
I can't say where the book came from. It is possible it was a messenger, a messenger heirloom, if you will. My best guess is it was either an artifact that they had already had or it was given to them by their god.
Right.
I don't think Landomir was involved in the messengers in any way, you know, because the messenger invasion happened during the invasion of Halomustis as just kind of a convenience thing, you know.
Right, but it's not like messengers aren't around at that time, because what's the one that, you know, has been around? I forget his name, but he's been around for a long, long time. He's been on Earth even.
Boris Ketlundi.
Yeah, Boris Ketlundi, that's right.
Yeah, but he was on Earth at this time. He's been on Earth for
years. Was, but I'm just saying it's not unfeasible that there would be messengers in association with the builder running around at this time, because the builder's got a lot of stuff going on, as we'll see throughout the next three books specifically.
Right. It wouldn't make any sense for them to be acting right now, though, because the messengers invaded when the builder invaded during the monster surge, because the magical membrane of this reality was all kind of funky. You know,
giving them
an easy access into it. So that's why the alliance was formed,
mm-hmm.
because they were going to be there because of the builder invading anyway, and they were going to serve as a distraction for the builder to get away with all these astral spaces, and then they were going to harvest all their servant races and everything from this.
Right, but so
to be there now, they like no reinforcements can come in until the builder invades. You know, the Palamustis is at a point where they're already preparing for the monster surge, so all they have is military mobilization available to go and attack the messengers wherever they are.
Right.
You know, so it's like, it would be like invading a military base that's prepared for war when there's actually no war happening. You know, the Messenger Builder Alliance, I don't think existed at this moment in time.
But weren't there messengers in the Builder cult itself?
No, I don't think there were. Because the messengers are the pinnacle of civilization. Why would they serve, you know, the cultists? Why would they serve
a servant race?
You know, they viewed the Builder cultists as a distraction for their own means. You know, they were the decoys. They were the servants that were dying so that we could take over this world. You know, it would go against their whole philosophy. No astral king is going to bow to the builder cult.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that is a fair point. Now, on the blood cult and the sanguine horror specifically, so as they're summoning this thing, like, do you think that there was like, is this going to be a familiar? Like, do you think they were trying to make it a familiar, or do you think that it was like they were just gonna like make it and set it to go out on its own, you know?
So I have done a lot of thought about this, and we talked about it a little bit. So the way that I see this all going down, right? I do believe that they're creating, like actually physically creating a sanguine horror. We know that it's a full body, you know, they actually make a physical body for it. We know that Jason loots it. There's no monster core, right?
Right.
What I think is happening is they're creating the body of a sanguine horror and then summoning the spirit of one from the astral to fill it for the purposes of being a familiar. You know, we know how bad this can go. We know the messengers can't even control a wild sanguine horror. I'm sure that would have been in the book, regardless of whoever wrote it. There would have been some kind of warning on the page, like, hey, don't let it run rampant or you're all going to die, because there's no way to stop it.
If it's just
right. I don't think they're trying to destroy the world. They just want power. So what I thoroughly believe is happening is they're creating a Seguin horror, and they have somebody in the cult with the essence ability to bond to a familiar, to this specific class of familiar, you know, and so they're going to create the horror. They're going to starve it until it's weak, basically, but at the rank they need it to be at. And then they're going to have that person come in and bond to it as a familiar. I fully believe that that is what's happening here. I even with Cressida alone being there, I don't think she is stupid enough to be like, hey, yeah, let's let it run rampant. I think at some stage, regardless of her position, she's going to be like, that's a very bad idea. We can't do that. You know, because I don't think she wants to die.
True. So then that brings me to where my imagination went when I was thinking of this. I was imagining Daryl being the person who gets the Seguin horror.
I think that's a very high likelihood.
And what I think is kind of funny about it is Daryl, in a way, is kind of a parallel to Jason. He's almost the anti-Jason, right?
Yeah.
So when we get introduced to Daryl, he is in a position of power, right? He potentially was going to be the person who was supposed to be the familiar holder to the Seguin horror. In that, though, so essentially he had all the power, but at the end of the day, he really is just like a regular dude who just happens to have all this power.
Oh yeah. Even they talk about like the looks, right? Like he's bronze rank, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So even at bronze rank, he's just an ordinary looking dude. And, you know, we see even as Jason ranks up to silver rank, you know, he's better looking, but he's still just an average looking dude.
Right.
Know, there's a lot of parallels drawn to that. You know, he's in this power because he fell into it. Mm-hmm. If he's going to have the Seguin horror, it'd be another person with a lot of power that he happens to have, looking kind of average with a Seguin horror as a familiar. It basically is the evil version of Jason.
Right. Like I said, he's like the anti-Jason. But the funny thing is, because he is so power obsessed, and rather he's a person with power that doesn't respect that power. You know what I mean? He's in a place of power, but he doesn't maintain his position with that power. He takes it for granted, and very obviously it screws him over multiple times in this series. Or at least the few times that we really get to see him. And then, you know, another parallel that we get later, the builder tries to take out Jason's soul, fights like hell, absolutely crazy. Builder loses. Right around that same time, he just takes Dougal's soul. No fight, no problem, throws him away. So it's like he is everything that Jason imagined himself to be in this world. And because he essentially doesn't want to end up being a Daryl, he goes about everything completely different.
Yeah. Yeah. And later on in these chapters, when he says, I'm the Daryl, aren't I? You know, it's set up as the way he looks kind of thing. But I think it is a lot deeper than that. You know, he doesn't 100%. Want to be the Daryl on the inside either.
Yeah. He sees what the Daryl means, you know, what being the Daryl is, and that is a weak man with a lot of power. And Jason's like, well, I'm a weak man and I'm trying to get a lot of power, but I'm not going to be a Daryl.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, 100%. Well, it's a good thing that he killed him, right?
I just realized that I was mixing Daryl and Dougal. Because the builder does not take Daryl. He takes Dougal.
He does. He lost a little bit there. But
okay, so either way. Dang. Well, Daryl is still a bit of an anti-Jason. And Dougal is another parallel of an anti-Jason.
Just without all of the power. He's got his shovel.
Which we've proven to be the most powerful thing in this universe because it's the only thing that shuts Jason up.
Yeah. Oh, man. Could you imagine Daryl on Team Biscuit? Not Daryl, Dougal. All right, new rule. No talking about Daryls or Dougals.
Leave the D out of it.
Leave the D out of it.
Now, speaking of parallels, the Sanguine Horror, I think, obviously, is a very obvious parallel to, you know, one of his most popular familiars in future. Now, here is a thought I was having, and I feel like we tread this ground a little bit in discussing that it was a potion, so I don't have as strong of an argument anymore, but I had been speculating about whether this could actually be Colin being summoned. You know what I mean? Like they were actually summoning a Sanguine Horror, and like, I can't imagine there's too many to go around, especially when a Sanguine Horror is, you know, a hive mind species. So you're not going to find a planet of multiple Sanguine Horrors. You'd find a planet with a horror.
I don't know. They exist in the astral, which reality doesn't exist in, so there could be a bunch of just Sanguine Horror. I think there are too. We know that this Sanguine Horror isn't Colin. We know this because I believe it's book 11, when they're talking about the fact that Jason has Colin and Gordon as familiars. Mm-hmm. You know, they're, it's mentioned that Colin was born, the Sanguine Horror entity was born at the exact same time that he was calling for a familiar. And that's how we got Colin. So Colin was born basically as a familiar. The same thing happened with Gordon. Gordon was born at the same time or near the same time that Jason was calling for a familiar. And
it's got a real
authentic reality assassin that he gets, you know, which isn't very rare or isn't very common. But that's the thing that really stood out to me in the later series books, because Colin is the same age as Jason's first ritual, you know, to summon him. So we know that this one isn't the real deal Colin.
Got you.
But it is very similar. So it's possible it was
a new
Sanguine Horror. It could have been an ancient Sanguine Horror. It could have been just a facsimile of a Sanguine Horror sent through the astral. We don't have a lot of information on this particular one.
Shoot, that's a good point.
But reading through it for the first time until you get to the later books, this is a possibility, you know? This is something that I was
thinking.
Like, it gave very much, you know, unlock boss after you beat it type energy. Like,
yeah, 100%.
Or you get this Sanguine Horror, you know?
Yeah.
Later on, you see what actually happened.
That is actually something that I thought was going to be a trope in this series, was that like he was going to collect the bosses.
Oh, 100%. 100%. When I was reading through it the first time, this happened and I was like, yeah, that's pretty dope. And then I was like, oh, this is going to happen a lot, isn't it?
Well, and then okay, so he beat the Mandrake and he gets this like super weird trowel thing, you know, the suspiciously sharp trowel. Then he beats the Sanguine Horror, and he gets the Sanguine Horror. So I assumed that there was going to be some trope about you know, him. Well, maybe there is a trope about him getting OP every time he faces something big.
I mean, yes. Most of that is due to his quest rewards, though. You know, like when he faced the elemental in the village and he got taken out by the whip, right? The silver rank elemental. I believe that's where he got his amulet of the Dark Guardian. But that was due to, you know, his abilities to loot and to complete quests, you know, getting something powerful. And then his later on racial evolution that gives him more stuff when he beats worse bosses, basically. So it is something, they always get something a little overpowered for doing something a little overpowered, you know, which is just your basic video game trope, you know, take down a boss, get a legendary item. But I straight up thought it was going to be a, hey, you did this thing, you get this thing type situation.
Yeah, 100%. And I'm glad that it was way more intricate than that.
Yeah.
Oh, but at the same time, that trope is almost there, though, because every time he faces some big, crazy boss, as Gary says way later, he just comes out with some ridiculous new soul power. Yeah. So it really kind of is beat boss, get OP.
Yeah. And that's how it's set up. That's what he needs. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Fair enough. Now,
but enough about the future. Let's get back to the Sanguine Horror real quick.
Right.
Important question for you. I think it's important. You might not, but let me give you some context here. So we go down. The Sanguine Horror is coming out of this blood pit, right? You know, we see it start up. You see, you know, leeches crawling out of the blood pool one by one. Then they pile up, and then we get to see the blood robes type situation. Mm-hmm. You know, it has the mummy strands that come out. So we know from this that it's bronze rank,
right?
You know, and reading through the series, it feels a lot like the Naga Genesis Egg in Book 10. Where it like starts off at iron or at bronze rank and then quickly grows to silver rank in strength.
Mm-hmm.
Reminded me a lot of kind of what's happening here. I believe it started out as iron rank and then just grew to bronze really, really quick. So my question is, do we think that's the rank that they were shooting for? Or do you think they were trying to summon this thing at like silver or gold rank and it just didn't reach that point yet?
Okay, so I do think they were going for a higher rank because, as we discussed before, I think, right, so the levels of the ritual room.
Yeah.
So essentially the ritual was intended to overflow and go up those levels.
That's what I believe is true, yes.
So I think with the feast stones that were on the cages, I think those were going to be used as like raw magic, like for the Sanguine Horror to consume to rank himself up as the ritual continued. So with every single person that he ate, he would get more biomass and he would get more magic pumped into his system, and potentially with, you know, the Sanguine Horror bisque recipe that we're going off of, that could be how to get its rank leveled up really quick during the summoning, like as it's being born, as it were.
100%. Yeah, I thought about this a lot too, because that's how I feel like it was meant to go. Like it would consume up the chamber and fill the chamber. And
right,
that doesn't happen here. I believe that those feast stones were designed to be eaten by the Sanguine Horror, you know, consume the raw magic of feasting and boost its biomass to the maximum potential for each rank, which would fill up one level, you know, then we sacrifice the next person and that feast stone boosts its biomass to the next level. You know, that's how right. Overall, I imagine that's the only way that these feast stones make sense to me.
Right.
Part of this ritual, because they're not necessary to actually create the horror.
Right.
But like to actually rank it up that far. That's why I was asking you what rank you think they were shooting for.
Because, yeah,
you know, that iron rank, he doesn't have that much biomass. You know, silver rank, we see something similar to that, you know, in the Messenger Caverns.
Right. Because, yeah, Iron Ring, he's just literally just the leech spray.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just little individual. Clump, you know? Yeah. It's just a clump of individual leeches. Yeah. It's not until Bronze Rank that he gets to the mummy form. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And when I was going through it, I was wondering, like, what the hell? Like, this ritual pops off without the feast stones. What were they for?
Yeah.
And. Yeah, that seems to be the only thing that would make sense, is that it's for rank progression, because otherwise, like, there's literally no other point for them to be there. But I will say it is super lucky that Jason was collecting those as they were getting out of the cages, because if they would have gotten to those feast stones, it's totally possible that it could have gotten out of their control way before they had any time to, like, get geared up to stop it.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, his casual find something, loot it type of his composure that he has, the way he goes about it, is very, very lucky in this instance. Mm-hmm. Because he's just finding cool stones and picking them up because they might be useful later. But also, right, he's protecting everybody from the advancement of the Sanguine Horror.
Dude, and that...
completely on accident. He saves the day on accident this time.
That is actually a really cool thought, too, because it's like... It could be more of that, like, inherent nature about him, you know, being this, like, Superman thing. I know we keep revisiting it, but I think it is one of the most important themes in this work right now, is that, like, you know, the Ubermensch Superman.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, this could be another, like, one of those inherent traits in there that are just there. And even though he does it without thinking, he acts heroically constantly, even in ways that are purely subconscious.
Yeah, that's just like his default is heroism, you know, and not until later when he actually understands that does he actually get the hero complex. He doesn't really understand he has a hero complex. He's just doing this all by chance originally, which is cool. It's the whole story. The whole story, he's acting the hero even if he means to or not.
So, yeah, that's a good point. However, his subconscious heroism doesn't really play out yet as conscious heroism entirely. We see a little bit of it, but before we even get to that, I had a weird thought about the Sanguine Horror.
Go ahead.
I think at Bronze Rank, it would be like kind of a really gross but fun fidget toy.
Explain.
Think about it. It's got the bandages, right? So imagine a big squishy something wrapped up, and you get to just squish it and punch it. And maybe punching it's a bad idea, but
yeah, Gary found that out the hard way.
He did, but it still could be a fun fidget toy. We could count it. Well, you're being a podiatrist.
Still sharp.
Oh,
geez. It's like a squish ball with razor blades.
Yeah. Okay. No, actually, though, squish ball with razor blades. I just caught that. Yeah. Okay. That's fair. Maybe not a good fidget toy, but I actually did have a real observation about the Sanguine Horror. So, if indeed this thing was not going to be a familiar, I know we've basically summed that it was definitely going to be, but just a fun thought that I had, that if it wasn't going to be a familiar, I don't think it really was all that dangerous of a situation.
I would agree.
Because they,
reasons, and then I'll tell you.
I was going to say, my reason is they are literally in the middle of the freaking desert. So sure, this thing could beat the ritual, eat through everything, get out of the chamber, and then it has to cross the desert with no source of food of any sort. Now, I guess maybe bronze rank would give it some advantage, but I can't imagine that it would just blindly know where to go.
Well, I feel and like it would seek out the nearest source of food always. If you wander far enough, you're going to find something regardless.
Well, sure, but like it's a desert. I feel like it would get lost in there and eventually just shrivel up and burn up in the sun, you know?
I do feel like, I think at bronze rank, it would have the survivability factor that it would need to survive the desert. The only thing it could eat, I guess, would be just small animals, small birds that maybe here and there. Definitely would give them enough time to go find a diamond ranker to handle it. I think the biggest issue with this line of thinking is the fact that there's a tunnel leading directly to the Vayne Estate from this chamber.
Right, so, but the estate is still in the desert, though.
It is, but I feel like it's a lot more well-resourced than anything. It's cannibals. There's tons of meat there that it can eat to get biomass. If it can get strong enough in this desert, it can live off the vegetation that's there and eat the vegetation and then eventually migrate from there. It would still have to cross the desert, but if it reaches the point where it can eat all the trees and the hedges that are over here, that might give it enough strength to make it to the nearest city.
That's a good point.
And it's a resilient little bugger, I'll tell you. So I think it would make its way to the surface, figure out it can't do that, and then go find the tunnel. Or the tunnel's right next to the blood pool. It might just go straight for the tunnel and find anything that's in there. And then at that point, it's just a crapshoot whether or not the diamond rankers can get there to deal with it in time or not. And if it divides its biomass, now you got to track down every single last leech. That would be horrible. If it gets to the surface and just decides to spread out in a radius pattern, you know, now you've got thousands of leeches crossing the desert. You have to kill everyone individually. Because if one of those leeches makes it to a town, you're done. You're screwed. You're fucked.
So, dude, the leech... So the Sanguine Horror is essentially a worse version of a Hydra. Or, sorry, I should say a scarier version of a Hydra, with the caveat that it does need to consume to replicate. However, it is purpose-built to consume.
Yeah, 100%.
So it's just a scarier Hydra. It's just like it's a Hydra on hard mode.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. It would have to, and we know that it can reach the point where even the strongest of messengers can't stop it. So if you don't stop it here and now, I don't think there's anybody that can stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a good thing they stopped it then.
Yeah. I mean, it really could have been spelled the end of the planet if things had gone correctly enough or wrongly enough for it to take hold before anyone could find out. Because here's the thing. Okay, you can absolutely assume, sure, a diamond ranker's gonna maybe get a chance. Not if they don't know it exists. If the Sanguine Horror had overtaken everybody here in this room, that spells the end of Palamustis, period.
Oh, 100%.
Because no one knows that it just did what it did. And so assuming Cressida had actually gotten this ritual to go all the way, you know, maybe this thing ends up at gold rank, possibly four stones, four ranks, maybe.
Maybe.
Assuming it ended up, you know, at a rank like that and then got loose, I don't think there would have been time for a Diamond Ranker or anyone to come and intervene whatsoever.
No, not at all. And that's the decision that they end up making here. You know, the team sees the ritual go off, and their first decision is, do we fight or do we run? Because the only chance they have of getting somebody stronger to deal with it is if they left right now. Mm-hmm. You know, they leave right now, they might be able to have it, have a chance of getting it down. If they decide to fight at all, that's out of the window, period. Which is real quick. That's crazy to me, because they, Rufus turns to Jason to make the decision, right? He's like, hey, you got us out of the cages. What do you want to do? And it's one of my favorite parts, because Jason on the inside is like, you have no idea how out of my element I am.
Right.
There's no possible way I can make this decision, you know? But it shows that they already trust him enough to have him make this decision.
Right.
And then it's, and then the beauty of Jason is he deflects immediately, like, hey, what are our actual chances? He doesn't answer the question. He doesn't. He's like, what are our actual chances of winning? And they're like, well, not great. And then Farrah happens to see Cressida's body. It's like, hey, I know where the keys to our collars are. And then immediately they just decide for him. They're like, okay, we're going to fight. Let's do it.
Right. At that point, though, Rufus tells Jason, like, all right, like, what can you do? And Jason's like, nothing. I'm very bad at fighting.
I and was taken so, out multiple times by a guy with a shovel.
Yeah, pretty freaking like, much.
I can't fight.
I cannot
You're
fight.
You're not understanding this.
And so we get Rufus telling Jason, don't die, which is like the don't die quest part two without the rewards. Yeah. Well, right. I guess the reward is not dying. But
yeah, life itself is the reward this time.
And at this point, he just nopes out. He's like, nope. All right. But here's my question.
Mm-hmm.
Where did he actually go? Because I know the first time in the last episode where he hides, he like is like they specifically say goes into the shadows, blah, blah, blah. And I know we can kind of assume that he did that, but like, specifically, where in the ritual room did he go? Because there are leeches going everywhere.
So the way I saw it in my own mind, in my mind's eye, if you will, Rufus says, stand back, try not to die, you know? So I think he just steps back to like right at the bottom of the staircase to this first level. You know, he's just kind of like back as far as he can from the pool until he sees the leeches start to crawl out. And then his non-magical mind is like, hey, that looks like a leech. And then I think in that moment, he's like, leeches don't like salt. There's salt upstairs. So I think during this entire battle
that's happening,
the entire situation after the leeches start emerging, I think is him making his way back up the stairs. Because he has to climb 4 or 5 levels. So I think it's just him going back up the stairs. So that's where he is. Like, he's against the wall until he sees the leeches, understands that they don't like salt, remembers the salt, and then the entire time he's just climbing stairs. I think that's what's happening.
Yo, 100%. I didn't even think about that. He's not noping out. He's like, I got a plan how I could help. I can't do much, but I can help.
Yeah. So it's like a little bit of, I'm trying to stay out of the way. And then 80% of the time they spend trying to fight it, he's making his way up the stairs while Fair is trying to get the keys.
So, and I mean, to be fair, like, salt and boots is pretty much like how you would fight leeches in real life.
Yeah.
So, like, Jason's plan is theoretically very sound. And I mean, it does indeed actually help.
Yeah. And that's something that I had written down here is just like a weird parallel, right? Because Palamustis, I'm assuming they don't really have to deal with leeches. And if they do, they're magical leeches, right? You know, so they wouldn't particularly be thinking about the Discovery Channel documentary they saw on leeches last night. You know, whereas on Earth, we have a lot much bigger understanding because of the way our science works. You know, he's like, leeches, right. Salt equals bad. You know, we would see a snail, be like, snails, salt equals bad. You know, but that's right. Not the kind of scientific research they focus on in this world. So it is 100% just his Earth knowledge getting the best of him, being like, hey, we don't have magic, but we have science. Mm-hmm. Let's go find some salt. And these adventurers are like, we need essence abilities.
Yeah, and I mean, so that actually makes me think of something that we kind of see with adventurers here specifically, is their entire lives have been adventuring. Ever since they were kids, they were prepping to do battles, fight with monsters, all of this. Jason very much not so.
Yeah.
So everyone in, like, all the adventurers, Farrah, Gary, and Rufus, they're all viewing Jason as a guy with wild battle strategies when he's literally just scared and trying to figure shit out.
100%.
But even Gary, like, comments on, you know, like, after the battle, Gary even comments on him saying, like, oh, wow, like, you being scared, that's such a good tactic.
Yeah.
Or I guess before the, not after, before the Sanguine Horror, but after the battle with Cressida and Daryl.
Yeah.
And it's just like saying, like, oh, wow, being scared, that's a fantastic tactic.
Yeah, it's like, you made them disregard you completely as a threat. Like, no, I'm just not a threat, bro. And from their perspective, you know, they're on an adventuring contract, a bronze rank bordering silver adventuring contract, you know, and they got taken by surprise and they couldn't figure it out. And then some rando walks in and actually figures it out. You know, he gets them free. So, you know, to them, he's doing something that one of the best trained adventuring teams there is couldn't figure out. So it's like, yeah, you say you're useless, but look what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like, you may not be an adventurer, but you have the spirit. You know, you've got plans, you've got tactics. Everything in their eyes is like, wow, this dude's really cool. It's like similar to how kids look at adults, like, wow, these guys have everything figured out. And adults are like, nope, we're just winging it.
Yep, just figuring it out as we go along. Don't know any, well, we know a little more than you do, but we don't know everything.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a similar vibe that I get from their perspective. You know, it's like, ah, we suck, this guy does it, and he's like, I suck, you need to keep me alive.
It's now, crazy. That is crazy. Now, during this battle, we see, like, the first real show-off-y version of, like, essences with Farrah using her lava, right?
Yeah.
And this, yet again, has introduced, to my mind, another nitpick I have with fire powers in general. So what I mean by that is, anytime you see a fire element of some form in anything, there's not enough actual radiant heat off of this item. So in my mind, she shoots a cannon of lava. Lava is very hot in the real world.
Yeah.
Very hot.
Molten rock.
It is literally molten rock. If she sprayed lava in the room, the radiant heat is going to fucking do damage beyond just wherever it's physically hitting is vaporized, and anything near it. So, like, I mean, obviously, like, Rufus is like, this is the part where we back up, which is, like, fair. But in general, and Sherloon's not the worst with it, but in general, like, if you look at, like, Pokemon, for example, like Magcargo, a lava slug. There's images of people hugging it. Dog, it's lava. Its Pokedex entries literally say it's, like, hotter than the sun.
Yeah.
Or a lightsaber, for example. If you had an object that actually did what a lightsaber does, you literally couldn't hold it that close to your body. You could hold it as far away from your body as you want, as you physically can, and it's still going to be hotter than you can handle.
I disagree with the lightsaber. We don't have to get into that if you want.
No, we literally see a lightsaber melt through fucking whatever metal steel doors that they have by just pushing it through. That is not insignificantly cold. You know what I mean?
True. But the idea of the lightsaber itself, right, being wielded by a Jedi, right? I guess for lack of a better term, the plasma that the lightsaber blade itself is actually made out of is being held in shape using the Force. So it would be reasonable to assume that the Force is containing the heat of that item within a certain periphery. And when you shove it through a door, right, it's the direct contact with the plasma that is actually melting. You know, it's space magic. It's containing the heat. We'll argue about that on a separate episode.
No, for sure. I don't like how many things in Star Wars can be just explained away with, it's just the Force.
Man. Harry Potter, yeah, it's magic. I think that's the point.
He writes with monsters, it's philosophy.
Yeah. I think in this case, you have standing. Okay, I would say that the majority of the lava that's being sprayed out by Farah is going into the blood pool, which is going to cool it very, very rapidly. So at the very least, we're going to have a very large amount of steam, which is still hot, but it's not as hot as the lava itself is. The radiant heat shouldn't do damage to Farah, who absorbs fire and heat for mana.
Sure, yeah.
Shouldn't really affect Gary or Rufus because they're bronze rank, right on the cusp of silver. So their tolerance for that environment, this is why they can run through the desert so well. Their tolerance is just not effective. Should absolutely turn Jason into a cookie or a biscuit, if you will. That Jason's a normal rank nobody. He should absolutely be destroyed by the radiant heat in this room. You know, the room was hot, now it's humid, but the remaining lava is casting a lot of heat. I think the initial blast should be like taking a flamethrower to the face, you know?
Sure.
He should not be as okay as he is, I'll give you that.
Now, on top of that, right after this, Jason comes floating down above the hot lava blood pit.
Before. He's already down when this happens. So he gets the salt. He floats down under mana toxin, by the way. Floats down using his cloak. Throws salt at the leeches. It works, so he continues to throw salt to keep them contained. And just as he does that, Farah unlocks her collar and then lava goes everywhere. That's when Rufus says, this is the part where we step back. And Jason goes, this is the part where we step back?
Right
now, really. So he's already down there. He bought exactly enough time for Farah to get her collar off. So at the very least, he's not over the boiling blood pit being hit with lava.
I'll give you that. That scene, though, is hilarious because he literally comes down like Mary Poppins mixed with Salt Bay.
Oh, straight up.
Like he comes straight floating up, down. What's he doing?
A void cloak sparkling with the stars.
Yeah, for real. Sprinkle no flavor on my Sanguine Horror.
for real.
Oh.
That's the Sanguine Horror. Pretty much covered. Pretty much done. In the final stages, final cleanup area. You have anything else you'd like to talk about? This massive boss battle?
I mean, boss battle wise, I think it was pretty effective and quick for them. I mean, they got lucky for sure.
100%. that they just nat 20'd this big BBEG, if you will.
Yeah, and that's fantastic for them because Palamustis, thankfully,
and Earth in the long run.
Oh yeah, I was gonna say, how was it gonna get to Earth?
Through Jason. destroyed Jason. Now Boris has to save the Earth.
Good point. No, so I mean, at least in terms of the battle, I think that's about all covered. What I do want to talk about, though, is what happens when we loot the Sanguine Horror.
Yes, probably one of the most incredible things ever. One of the best hidden foreshadowings that we've seen so far. Because he comes over, he finds the one little piece of this Sanguine Horror, like the last little minuscule piece that's big enough for him to actually loot. Mm-hmm. You know, we get that kind of touch it with his toe kind of thing. And it's like, yeah. Oh, I can loot it. Cool. But he does. He loots it. You know, he gets some spirit coins. But the big thing that he gets is the Awakening Stone of the Apocalypse. Which is, first of all, sounds crazy immediately, right? And this is going to be the thing that ends up giving him Colin as a familiar. And this right here, at the start of the series, when you're first reading through it, this is one of those, you know, you just unlock the boss as a playable character type moments. And it absolutely is just like that in a video game, too.
Right.
You know, bronze rank boss unlocked at iron rank type situation.
Right.
You get far enough down the road. You know, we talked about this a little bit, how incredibly difficult it is to get a Sanguine Horror as a familiar. You know, this is the first real evidence we see of what you could call divine intervention. You know, like this is the, I think it was the great astral beings that allowed this to happen pretty much, you know, because he gets this Awakening Stone as part of.
So was it World Phoenix that granted him the Apocalypse Stone, or was it Reaper?
I don't think it's actually stated who did this. I think it's heavily implied that it was the World Phoenix.
Right. Because she definitely has her hand in the pot right now with everything that Jason's doing without him knowing. But she is 100% making things happen.
Yeah. And it would not be that difficult to like drop an Awakening Stone real quick, you know, to tweak the magic enough to provide him with that. Through his looting ability, because I know the Reaper's Blessing gave him Shade. I don't think the Reaper would be in charge of giving him two familiars. He doesn't have that big of a invested interest in Jason at the moment. But it's like, it's actually divine intervention that we see explained later that we don't get to really think about until way later. You know, it's now mentioned here and there that it's weird that he has this, but also massive foreshadowing, and we play it off as you just unlock the boss.
Now, do you think that applies to all of his Awakening Stones or just this one in specific?
How do you mean?
Well, so I guess he gets the Awakening Stone of Adventure right here as well, for not being sacrificed,
right?
Now, do you think that? I guess this goes back on that like fate sensors versus divine intervention situation, I guess, where were these fate sensors giving him the, you know, Stone of Adventure based on how he's performing, like we discussed before, or are all of his stones handpicked by the World Phoenix or the divine intervention?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I think the Awakening Stone of Adventure comes from the fact that he's acting like an adventurer. You know, I think that's I think that's mostly like a writing style choice. That so Sherdaloon gave him this Awakening Stone as kind of a prelude to, hey, you're going to be an adventurer type thing. A little Easter egg for us as the readers.
Right.
A power that matches that in this world. I can't imagine the Awakening Stone of Adventure would be like that hard of an essence to see. I don't think it's like
probably a relatively, actually thinking about it, it's probably a relatively common essence or Awakening Stone.
Let's see if I have that written down. Yeah, it has it marked unranked common, so it's a common Awakening Stone in this world.
Right,
so it's not like something he wouldn't see It's just, I think it's just his looting ability giving him that particular one because of how he acted in this moment.
Like we discussed before.
Yeah. A lot of the Awakening Stones that he gets in the future are, you know, looted from specific circumstances, you know. He's in the astral space. He gets a lot of Awakening Stones of the Reaper because it's the Reaper's space. He gets, you know, Dark Awakening Stones, and he gets plant-based Awakening Stones and essences. And so I think very, very few of them, you know, the only things that are that uncommon are the familiars that he gets. You know, he gets Gordon as a familiar, super incredibly rare. You know, nobody would understand why the All-Devouring Eye would send an actual reality assassin to Jason as a familiar. You know, Shades came as a blessing, you know, from the Reaper. The Reaper specifically gave him Shade as a familiar. Everything else, I think, is just circumstantial.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. Now here's just a fun little thought project for you.
All right.
If you were to look at your life right now and like just the way you live your life in general, what do you think would be your awakening stones? So for me, so I'll let you think about that for a second. For me, So I think my awakening stones would reflect something like, you know, my intellect would probably play in there. So I don't know, the awakening stone of intellect, you know? And then I think music would probably, or maybe art in general. I don't know. Is there an awakening stone of the arts or something? I'm sure there is.
I think you're thinking more broadly, like these would be essence type things, you know, like awakening stones are very specific, like awakening stone of the feast instead of awakening stone of eating.
Right. I am using the wrong terminology.
Yeah. You'd be like awakening stone of the song, you know, as a singer.
Right. No, I was totally thinking about essences. I always get those backwards.
I think this would be a very, very, very cool thing to do
as a
video, like a separate video.
Okay,
you know, well, I think we can fully blow through 2 or 3 hours of what are our essences, what are our awakening stones, what are our abilities, you know. I think we should absolutely put this down as a topic to cover as its own separate video.
That's a good point. So here soon we'll make a video about what we think our essences and maybe our awakening stones and all that fun stuff. So come check out our YouTube at Team Biscuit and give us a holler there.
Yes, that's at Team Biscuit HWWWN.
Oh. All right. So this is going to be way out of left field. But as I was going through this, I was thinking about the characters of Farrah, Gary, and Rufus. And something stood out to me that I thought was really funny, but a little out of pocket.
All right.
So Rufus tends to have, in his conversation and banter, he tends to play, you know, the straight-laced character, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, everyone's bantering, joking, and his contribution to the jokes is to say something just completely flat, off topic or too serious or this or that, you know, just a typical straight man kind of vibes to his conversation.
Yeah. Just like, shut up you two, or hey, let's focus, something like that.
I then found it to be really funny to think about the fact that Rufus is canonically gay in the series.
Yeah.
So he's a gay man who's the straight man.
Yeah.
I don't know. That. I thought it was some absurd shit that I picked up on.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, throughout the whole series, I thoroughly enjoy, you know, we see a lot of characters that are either gay or bisexual, mm-hmm. you know, and you see a lot of, you know, media out there You have TV shows and movies, you know, who make a big deal out of the fact that they have a gay character or they have a non-normal character, if you will.
Right.
You know, and throughout this whole series, it comes up a lot. You have a lot of characters that are gay, that are that bisexual, you know, that are straight, but it is never like made a deal of, you know, it's just a generally accepted thing. You know, we see when we first find out that, you know, Rufus is gay, you know, it's like, hey, you know, we'll have a lot of young women at this party. He's like, no, that's okay. And they're like, oh, we'll have a lot of young men there too.
Yeah.
You know, it's like just right. A little nod, you know, and I absolutely adore, you know, the fact that Shirtaloon can write in, you know, a character that is gay or bisexual without having to explicitly promote the fact that they're gay and bisexual. You know, it's just an accepted form. You know, nobody has an issue with it. Nobody makes a deal about it. You know, it's just that's who they are, and we love them and accept them for it. We don't need to make this a big deal.
Right.
You know? And it's so flawless the way that he does that.
Yeah, and that is something I picked up on early on listening through this, is you do get a lot of those characters going in and out through the series, and never once is it ever made out to be that there's something wrong with them or something weird with them or anything like that. They're just another character in the story doing their thing and, you know, just being people. And, you know, I love to see that kind of representation where you can have a character whose entire identity is not just their sexual identity. Right. Because that's a big thing in like the PC culture, as it were. It's just like, you know, everything becomes this, you know, like, oh, like that's the gay character. That's
right.
The trans character. And then everything to do with that character is on that topic, to do with that subject. The characters are generally there as a vehicle for that conversation, but it's like, okay, but it's ham-handed. And right. he does it so eloquently in that it's not mentioned. They're just characters in the story.
Right.
Just like in real life. It's not mentioned. They're just people.
Right. No, and there is nothing that will take me out of a story faster than, you know, this person's entire identity is the fact that they're gay. You know, like there's no substance. Right. There's no anything. Like, I have absolutely no issues, you know, with people living their life, being who they are, you know, and that's my favorite thing about this series. It's like, you know, Rufus isn't the gay character, you know, he is Rufus Ramore, and he happens to be gay, you know, that is who he is, but that's not all he is.
Right. And that's why I picked this out as a comment, which like, I was like, that could be Shirtaloon straight memeing on the fact, like it's so common that he's going to even write, like, so common in his world to just be normal with all this shit that he's going to write a character that is literally a joke on that, like, on that trope.
Yeah.
Because he's literally a gay man who plays the straight man.
Right.
That's fantastic. It's like, because you could definitely argue that him being the straight man is way more his identity than him being a homosexual man in the series.
Oh, 100%. No, he is the straight-laced adventurer that was raised to lead adventurers, you know?
Yeah.
And that's, like, language-wise, that's funny.
Yeah, 100%. Exactly. And we've seen that Shirtaloon really does like to twist and play with language. So to me, it is not beyond me that this was absolutely the joke he was trying to make here.
Oh yeah.
With Rufus as a character. Or it could even go the other way. Maybe it was never necessarily intended for him to be gay, but he wanted to put it in there to still have this as the joke, you know?
Yeah.
One way or the other. Still really good, and it still really works.
It does. It does.
Um,
Rufus, let's talk about Farrah and Gary for a minute. Farrah.
Fairy. Now, okay, but actually, in general, there's one last thing on this.
Okay.
that we actually see implement here. In general, I think the best way to put all of that is everybody in Palamustis is just more comfortable with other people being people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So,
and maybe this is because they're a society where anybody can be anything, you know, or it could be we have more important things to deal with than who's gay and who's not.
You right. know,
it's the full acceptance. Everybody is their own person. It's not about what you are. It's about who you are. And it's about what you do with who you are.
Right. Because like literally after the battle, we see all of them changing. And it's literally described as like they're just athletes in a locker room. No one's shy about anything. No one's being like, oh, all weird about it. They're just being comfortable with themselves.
Yeah.
And being comfortable with each other as friends.
Right. And this could be just due to the fact that they've been an adventuring team for so long, you know, that they're just fully comfortable with each other no matter what.
Right.
They are. They are hardcore adventurers. And we see this a lot, especially in this kind of cool down gear up type scene. You know, we see everybody kind of changing, doing their thing. Farrah hands Jason some water because he can't take a potion. This kind of stood out to me. She's like, yeah, you can't take a potion for another couple of hours at least. And then it's like Jason looks at his cooldown timers and it's like a little over 2 hours for his mana toxin to run out.
Right. And
the fact that she just knew that, you know, this is the cooldown for that affliction is like... Hmm. Like she's dealt with that before, you know, they just kind of instinctively know they don't have the cooldown timers.
They just know yeah. They see.
Yeah. And you pair that with the, you know, the trowel scene with Gary and with Rufus and, you know, the way they fought here.
Mm.
They are very experienced adventurers.
Yeah. And definitely. And there's a lot of team cohesion that we see a lot of here. Like honestly, like when sending Farrah to go get the keys, mm-hmm. like that's kind of, you know, almost kind of like turning a gender role on its head in a way, where typically in most stories the female is the damsel in distress, and in this situation she's like, I'm gonna go do this shit, and everyone else is like, yeah, she's gonna go do that shit.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's a lot of trust in them as a team, as people with their own capabilities. And like, you know, and it's so casual, like when she shoots the lava, even Rufus, you know, it's time to step back. Like it's a casual moment for him. It's not even like a, you know, like he's not worried about her not being able to handle the monster. He's like, all right, let's step back, let her do her thing.
Yeah. Well, I think overall he decided to send her after the keys, you know, because she is their main damage dealer. She is the immediate burst of damage, you know. So his trust in her to succeed, right? It was never a, if you succeed, your powers would be useful. It's a, you're gonna go do this shit. I know you, I've worked with you. A full trust, like you go get it, because as soon as you get that collar off, you can just take care of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and as soon as that lava starts coming out, he's like, yep, we win, everybody back up. Which is crazy, because he's like, you go get the collar, we're gonna stand here and do nothing. They have no way of fighting this.
Yeah.
You know, Rufus and Gary are standing there not doing anything. Gary's getting eaten up a little bit, but yeah, it's the full amount of trust. Like, we're gonna pretend like we're helping. You're going to take care of the problem.
So, okay, this is like something from way earlier that I just totally forgot. We were talking about Daryl, and I just thought about this with Gary and Rufus.
Mm-hmm.
What essence do you think Daryl was using to pin Gary and Rufus to the wall? Because, like, in my mind, that's a very, like, the Force kind of ability. And it's a super quick in passing thing. And I was just thinking about that. You're saying they were doing nothing. And I was like, oh, Right. They were also doing nothing. So really, in this scenario, Farrah is the only one that Farrah and Jason are the only ones that do anything. Gary just harms himself by thinking he can punch a leech-shaped fidget toy. Yeah. And up to that point, Rufus hadn't done anything. Then they were pinned to the wall by Daryl.
Oh, Rufus and Gary took care of Anissa. Not Anissa.
Oh.
Alicia,
yeah.
Yeah.
So
they contributed. Just okay, not they, in a way fair. That really matters.
Fair. Okay, but getting back to the point. What essence do you think Daryl was using?
I don't know. It would have to be some kind of spell, right? Some containing magic.
Oh, you're right. I'm thinking like essence power, and I'm like, what essence?
No, it could have been the spell that unlocked with his essence. It could be an awakening stone. It'd be some kind of prison magic, I would imagine.
Right.
So like awakening stone of the cage or.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Some bondage kinky stuff.
Hey, yo.
We don't judge.
We don't judge. Not around here.
Yeah, I have no idea. Some kind of imprisoning magic, I would say.
Interesting. Well, they're not on the wall anymore, and now everyone's naked.
Yeah, that's pretty much how this goes. Welcome to being an adventurer.
Hey. And so Jason, in this scenario, is looking at all of them and feeling... It's a real feels bad moment for him because he's looking at all of them and like athletes in a locker room, they are cut. They are fit. Yes, sexy are. Freaking people. And Jason looks down at himself and is like, I'm the Daryl. And
remembering the connection between Cressida and Daryl. It's like beautiful high priestess, Daryl.
Daryl. And he's like, I'm the Daryl. So, anyway, that like this is the first time he actually puts the shirt on that he got, by the way.
Yeah, see, seeing everybody change, he remembers he had a shirt. Like at the moment, he's just wearing pants and sandals.
Right, which is funny because he made such a fuss about not having a shirt or clothing in general. I mean, I guess the pants and sandals kind of covered the clothing issue for the most part.
Yeah.
But like...
Even he's had the shirt. And stuff, like, why doesn't he have a shirt? You took his shirt away? Like, no, he just wasn't wearing a shirt. I don't know.
No, super weird. Actually, though, did I tell you I have one of those shirts?
Like, a shirt in general? You're wearing one.
Well, yeah, I'm wearing a shirt. No, I'm saying I went to Palamustis as an Outworlder, and I actually got one of these shirts. Yeah, hold on. I gotta get in my inventory. Hold on. Right. So, I went to a magical universe, and all I got was vast cosmic power.
I have so many questions.
Hold on. You don't have one though?
No, I don't have an inventory. I don't have an inventory.
Hold on a sec. Yeah. Yeah, I had two of them.
Well, can I have one?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So many questions. How do you...
No. I'll do you one better, though. I'll do you one better, though. Ready for this? I've been learning some magic. Yeah.
Dude.
There we go. Feels good.
That was incredible. Does mine do that?
Yeah, I mean, it should. Try it.
How do you do it? You just throw it at yourself and it comes on?
Yeah, it'll do it.
nothing happened.
Yeah, think about like wearing, think about like you're wearing it, like imagine the feeling of it being on. All right,
it's all mental, you saying?
Yeah.
Bro.
Yeah.
This is the coolest thing you've ever given me.
Yes, sir.
I'm not gonna ask questions. I'm just gonna accept the fact that I have it and it's enchanted.
For anyone listening, audio only, we just did a sight gag where we swapped some shirts on with the power of editing. Corny.
And ruined magic. Yeah, go check out our video.
Was inside of us.
It was inside of us all along.
But yeah, so if you're listening to audio only, check us out on YouTube. Now, so I want to wrap up this podcast today with a bit of a quandary question.
Question.
Theorization. So the end of chapter 14, they're talking about the difference between a horse and a Heidel, right?
Right.
And it brought to mind a thought that, you know, because I was like imagining what a Heidel would look like. And I was like, oh, that's really weird. And then I was like wondering, are there any animals on Earth that we would have a hard time explaining to an outworlder?
I mean, aside from a horse.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I guess in a scenario, something that I guess even we might find to be a bit weird.
Yeah, I would say, like in a situation like this, right? Like, kind of like a normal animal for people of an area where it exists, but is completely ridiculous to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Type situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you say platypus, I swear to God.
Platypi don't exist. They are just beavers walking backwards. Change my mind. Anyway. Oh. Dude. I would say, okay. You ever heard of the red-lipped batfish?
The what?
Red-lipped batfish. It's like a batfish. I think that is a perfect example.
I don't think I have.
Hold on. So it's basically, right, it's just a fish with a flat face,
mm-hmm,
that walks. It's got big poofy red lips.
I don't think that this is a real animal. It walks with a flat face and red lips.
Yeah, let me see if I can pull up a picture here for you. Yeah, check this out. Look at that. A big little nose.
I was gonna say, you said it had a flat face. That is a big freaking nose.
But the rest of it is flat. Look at that thing, that pucker lips. It's basically the Karen of the sea.
Yeah, it wants to talk to the manager of the ocean.
Yes, it does. And these things just kind of walk around a little bit. But yeah, I mean, look at that. I just explained it to you, right?
That is not what I was imagining whatsoever.
That's kind of, I don't know. That's one of those things. The first time I heard about it, I was like, really weird. Heard about it on Facebook, so couldn't really confirm. But yeah, research into this animal. It actually exists. And I imagine if you're in an area where this is like a common thing, It's kind of weird, but it's just like a fish.
Now, is this an Australian animal or?
I have no idea. I don't know where it is. I just know that it exists.
Now, that fish, let's put her back up on screen. Okay, it reminded me of something else another creature that I've seen that's really famous for its appearance, but its appearance has actually been modified in a way so what we know it as is not actually like the same as what it really looks like. So you're familiar with the blobfish?
Yeah, fish looks like blob.
Fish look like sad blob thing.
Yeah.
The only reason they look like that is when they're pulled up. They're a deep sea fish. When they're pulled up, they literally expand. I actually have an image of the two of them side by side, what they're supposed to look like, and then what they look like when they're under the wrong pressure. But they're literally just a normal looking fish.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. This is one of my favorite things too, because it's like the pressure of the sea makes fish, no pressure makes blob.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, explain that to somebody who doesn't know what a blobfish is.
Oh, so anyway, Karen of the Sea, Blobfish,
Heidel.
Those would be all of those are very weird animals that I think don't quite fit in with normal animal expectations.
True dat.
Well, so for the to wrap this up though, I want to just make a quick shout out to Shirtaloon himself, or at least a message about him. At the time of recording, he is in the hospital, and he's mentioned something that his blood was turning acidic and turning against him. So, Mr. Shirtaloon, we here at He Who Writes on Monsters want to wish you a fast recovery, and we just hope, you know, we love your work, and we just hope that you're doing well and going to get through this soon.
Yes. Yes. And at the time of the release of this video, book 12 is scheduled to come out next week. We are very excited. We cannot wait to see what you've done here from book 11 and onward. We cannot wait to see what happens to Jason, and we cannot wait to have you back with us. So
absolutely. Do everything you need
to do, get well, and come back to us.
Absolutely. Well, I think that's going to do it for today.
I think so. Tune back in for episode 5 and see what happens to the team after they don't get sacrificed.
All right. Well, I've been D. Allen.
I've been Donnie B. Come check us out on social media, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. And this has been the He Who Writes with Monsters podcast. Blobfish.
Fuck.